From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!, broadcasting from Madison, Wisconsin.
On the morning of 9/11, the existing protocol was unsuited in every respect for what was about to happen. What ensued was the hurried attempt to create an improvised defense by officials who had never encountered or trained against the situation they faced.
The 9/11 Commission says chaos and miscommunication left the U.S. unprepared for the September 11th attacks. We'll hear excerpts of the hearings, including the voices of the hijackers on the planes and a minute-by-minute account of President Bush's reactions on the morning of the attacks. Then we'll talk with the authors of the new book, Banana Republicans, How the Right Wing is Turning America into a One-Party State.
24 hours after the 9/11 Commission concluded there's no credible evidence linking Saddam to the 9/11 attacks, Dick Cheney and George Bush are still using the big lie tactic to confuse the American people.
And as the race for the presidency intensifies, we'll look at the battleground state of Wisconsin with the state's leading rebel lawyer, Ed Garvey.
This will be a battleground state, but Tommy Thompson, who was governor here for almost 16 years, has taken failed programs from Wisconsin to Washington, and we're pretty confident the people are onto the game.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, broadcasting from Madison, Wisconsin. I'm Amy Goodman. Plagued by miscommunication and confusion, U.S. aviation and military officials were entirely unprepared for the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. This, according to the 9/11 Commission in its report yesterday. In the final public hearing, the Commission detailed a series of communication breakdowns at the White House, Pentagon, and Federal Aviation Administration so severe that jet fighters were sent to chase phantom aircraft while real airliners crashed undisturbed into their targets, killing nearly 3,000 people. The top commander at NORAD, the North American Aerospace Division Defense Command, told the commission that the military could have shot down the hijacked planes that subsequently hit the World Trade Center and Pentagon if it had received more timely information from the FAA. We'll have more on this story in a few minutes. Earlier in the week, the 9/11 Commission's announced it had found no credible evidence that Iraq aided al-Qaeda in the September 11th attacks and that Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda had never established close ties. This finding directly contradicts earlier statements from both President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney. On Thursday, both appeared publicly to claim again that such ties did indeed exist. President Bush spoke at the White House.
Oh, the reason I keep insisting that there was a relationship between Iraq and Saddam and al-Qaeda, because there was a relationship between Iraq and al-Qaeda.
Cheney added, quote, "The fact of the matter is the evidence is overwhelming." Meanwhile, over at the Pentagon, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said, if the U.S. fails in Iraq, it is not because of what took place on the battlefield, but how the media has portrayed it. He said, quote, "This much is certain. Coalition forces cannot be defeated on the battlefield. The only way this effort could fail is if people were to be persuaded that the cause is lost or that it's not worth the pain, or if those who seem to measure progress in Iraq against a more perfect world convince others to throw in the towel." Rumsfeld also admitted Thursday he ordered an Iraqi man to be secretly held without giving him an official detainee number or informing the International Committee of the Red Cross of his existence. The newly appointed Iraqi defense minister said Iraq is considering declaring martial law in response to a pair of car bombings on Thursday that killed 41 people and injured over 150. House-to-house searches may also take place to look for the killers. The minister said, quote, "We will cut off the hands of those people. We will slit their throats if it's necessary to do so." A federal grand jury has indicted a private contractor working for the CIA for beating to death a detainee in Afghanistan. This marks the first time a civilian has faced criminal charges related to the detainee torture scandal. Meanwhile, in Iraq, the U.S. military has charged an army officer with the murder of a follower of Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan has urged the U.N. Security Council to stop exempting the U.S. from international prosecution for war crimes, in part because of the abuses carried out by the U.S. forces in Iraq. Annan said on Thursday, quote, "It would be unfortunate for one to press for such an exemption given the prisoner abuse in Iraq. It would even be more unwise on the part of the Security Council to grant it. It would discredit the Council and the United Nations that stands for rule of law and primacy of rule of law," Annan said. The current exemption for the U.S. ends on June 30th. The Los Angeles Times is reporting the Republican-led Senate has voted down an amendment by Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy that would have made war profiteering a crime. The Senate also rejected a proposal to prohibit private contractors from interrogating detainees. Otto Reich, the Bush administration's special advisor in Latin America, has resigned. This according to the White House National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice. In a written statement, Rice said Reich provided good judgment and advice for President George W. Bush's policies in Latin America, such as a commission recommending how to, quote, hasten the day when Cuba will be a free country. Rice said she accepted Reich's resignation with regret. Democrats such as Senator Christopher Dodd of Connecticut faulted Reich for his involvement in covert efforts to support the Contras in Nicaragua in the 1980s. Bush used a legislative maneuver to temporarily install Reich as Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs in January 2002 after the Senate, then controlled by the Democrats, refused to confirm him. After that appointment expired December 2002, Bush named Reich the next month to an advisory position that did not require Senate confirmation. A new poll commissioned by Mother Jones magazine has found 95% of African Americans feel the country is headed in the wrong direction. The poll found the overall percentage of Americans who feel that way is 62%. On the campaign front, 22 Democratic members of Congress have co-signed a letter to John Kerry, urging him to select Senator John Edwards as his running mate over former House Minority Leader Richard Gephardt. This according to a report in The Hill. And in New Hampshire, 94-year-old Doris Haddock, better known as Granny D, has announced she will challenge Republican Judd Gregg for his Senate seat. Jacob's Ladder, Chumbawamba here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, broadcasting from Madison, Wisconsin, a battleground state. I'm Amy Goodman. Plagued by miscommunication and confusion, U.S. aviation and military officials were entirely unprepared for the September 11th attacks in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania, the 9/11 Commission reported yesterday. In its final public hearing, the commission detailed a series of communications breakdowns at the White House and the Pentagon so severe that jet fighters were sent to chase phantom aircraft while real airliners crashed undisturbed into their targets, killing 3,000 people. The staff report included an exhaustive minute-by-minute recreation of the morning of the attacks, showing there had never been a hope of intercepting and shooting down the planes. Relatives of September 11th victims attending the hearing listened through tears to the recordings of the hijackers' voices, which were captured on radio transmissions and picked up by the air traffic controllers. The terrorist remarks had been cited in news reports, but never before played publicly.
At 8:24 and 38 seconds, the following transmission came from American 11.
We have some planes. Just stay quiet and you'll be okay. We're returning to the airport.
The controller only heard something unintelligible. He did not hear the specific words, quote, "We have some planes," end quote. The next transmission came seconds later.
Nobody moved. Everything will be okay. If you try to make any move, you'll injure yourself and the airplane. Just stay quiet.
Hearing that transmission, the controller told us he then knew it was a hijacking. The controller alerted his supervisor, who assigned another controller to assist him, and redoubled efforts to ascertain the flight's altitude. Because the controller didn't understand the initial transmission, the manager of Boston Center instructed the center's quality assurance specialist to, quote, pull the tape of the radio transmission, listen to it closely, and report back. Between 8:25 and 8:32, in accordance with the FAA protocol, Boston Center managers started notifying their chain of command that American 11 had been hijacked. At 8:28, Boston Center called the command center in Herndon, Virginia, to advise management that it believed American 11 had been hijacked and was heading towards New York Center's airspace. By this point in time, American 11 had taken a dramatic turn to the south. At 8:32, the command center passed word of a possible hijacking to the operations center at FAA headquarters. The duty officer replied that security personnel at headquarters had just begun discussing the hijack situation on a conference call with the New England Regional Office. The Herndon Command Center immediately established a teleconference between Boston, New York, and Cleveland centers so that Boston Center could help the others understand what was happening. At 8:34, the Boston Center controller received the third transmission from American 11.
The voice heard in those recordings is to believe to be that of Mohammed Atta, the 9/11 hijacker. In their recreation of the morning of the September 11th attacks, the 9/11 Commission detailed a chronology of communications by aviation and military officials.
At 8:37 and 52 seconds, Boston Center reached NEADS. This was the first notification received by the military at any level that American 11 had been hijacked.
Hi, Boston Center, TMU. We have a problem here. We have a hijacked aircraft headed towards New York, and we need you guys to—we need someone to scramble some F-16s or something up there to help us out.
Is this real world or exercise?
No, this is not an exercise, not a test.
NEADS promptly ordered to battle stations the two F-15 alert aircraft at Otis Air Force Base, about 153 miles away from New York City. The Air Defense of America began with this call.
Accounts of the numerous communications breakdowns on the morning of September 11th were detailed throughout the commission's report.
NORAD did not know about the search for American 77. Instead, they heard once again about a plane that no longer existed, American 11. At 9:21, NEADS received a report from the FAA.
Military Boston Center just had a report that American 11 is still in the air and it's on its way heading towards Washington.
American 11 is still in the air?
Yes,
on its way towards Washington?
There was really another aircraft. drafted at the tower. That's the latest report we have.
Okay.
I'm going to try to confirm an ID for you, but I would assume he's somewhere over either New Jersey or somewhere further south.
Okay, so American 11 isn't a hijack at all then, right?
No, he is a hijack.
American 11 is a hijack.
Yes.
And he's going into Washington?
Could be a third aircraft.
This mention of a, quote, third aircraft, unquote, was not a reference to American 77. There was confusion at that moment in the FAA. Two planes had struck the World Trade Center, and Boston Center had heard from FAA headquarters in Washington that American 11 was still airborne. We have been unable to identify the source of this mistaken FAA information.
The 9/11 Commission's report also found that an executive order by Vice President Dick Cheney that gave the military permission to shoot down hostile aircraft did not come until long after the last hijacked airliner had crashed.
At 9:49, 13 minutes after getting the question from Cleveland Center about military help, Command Center suggested that someone at headquarters should decide whether to request military assistance.
They're pulling Jeff away to talk about United 93.
Do we want to think about scrambling aircraft?
Oh, God, I don't know.
That's a decision somebody's going to have to make probably in the next 10 minutes.
Everybody just left the room.
The timeline of the events detailed in the Commission's report demonstrated that the last of the four planes had crashed well before Cheney authorized the shootdowns. The panel also found that due to miscommunication and uncertainty, the shootdown orders were never passed on to fighter pilots.
In upstate New York, NEAD's personnel first learned of the shootdown order from that chat log message.
You need to read this. The region commander has declared that we can shoot down aircraft that did not respond to our direction. Copy that?
Copy that, sir.
So if you're trying to divert somebody and he won't divert?
CO's saying no.
No? Came over the chat. You got a conflict on that direction?
Right now, no. But
okay. Hey, okay. You read that from the vice president, right? Vice President has cleared.
Vice President has cleared us to intercept track.
You know what they have?
Let's shoot them down if they do not respond first on RCC.
In interviews with us, NEAD's personnel expressed considerable confusion over the nature and effect of the order. Indeed, the NEAD's commander told us he did not pass along the order because he was unaware of its ramifications. Both the mission commander and the weapons director indicated they did not pass the order to the fighters circling Washington and New York City because they were unsure how the pilots would or should proceed with this guidance. In short, while leaders in Washington believe the fighters circling above them have been instructed to, quote, take out, end quote, hostile aircraft, the only orders actually conveyed to the Langley pilots were to, quote, ID, type, and tail.
After its account of the September 11, 2001 attacks, the commission summarized its conclusions.
NORAD officials have maintained that they would have intercepted and shot down United 93. We are not so sure. We are sure that the nation owes a debt to the passengers of United 93. Their actions saved the lives of countless others and may have saved either the U.S. Capitol or the White House from destruction. The details of what happened on the morning of September 11th are complex, but the details play out a simple theme. NORAD and the FAA were unprepared for the type of attacks launched against the United States on September 11, 2001. They struggled, under difficult circumstances, to improvise a homeland defense against an unprecedented challenge they had never encountered and had never trained to meet.
That was the 9/11 Commission's conclusion on U.S. defense systems. Among the new information contained in the report is a detailed reconstruction of the reactions of President Bush on the morning of the attacks.
The president was seated in a classroom of second graders when, at approximately 9:05, Andrew Card whispered to him, quote, a second plane hit the second tower. America is under attack, close quote. The president told us his instinct was to project calm, not to have the country see an excited reaction at a moment of crisis. The National Press Corps was standing behind the children in the classroom. He saw their phones and pagers start to ring. The president felt he should project strength and calm until he could better understand what was happening. The president remained in the classroom for another 5 to 7 minutes while the children continued reading. He then returned to a holding room shortly before 9:15, where he was briefed by staff and saw television coverage. He then spoke to Vice President Cheney, Dr. Rice, Governor Pataki, and FBI Director Mueller. He decided to make a brief statement from the school before leaving for the airport. The Secret Service told us they were anxious to move the president to a safer location, but did not think it was imperative for him to run out the door. Between 9:15 and 9:30, the staff was busy arranging a return to Washington while the president consulted his senior advisors about his remarks. No one in the traveling party had any information during this time that other aircraft were hijacked or missing. As far as we know, no one was in contact with the Pentagon. The focus was on the president's statements to the nation. No decisions were made during this time other than the decision to return to Washington. The president's motorcade departed at 9:35 and arrived at the airport between 9:42 and 9:45. During the ride, the president learned about the attack on the Pentagon. He boarded the aircraft, asked the Secret Service about the safety of his family, and called the vice president. According to notes of this call, at about 9:45, the president told the vice president, quote, "Sounds like we have a minor war going on here. I heard about the Pentagon. We're at war. Somebody's going to pay."
The account of President Bush's reaction on the morning of September 11th attacks in the 9/11 Commission report. The report is the last interim staff report before the commission races to complete its book-length final report by the end of July. This is Democracy Now! As we turn to John Nichols, who is the editorial editor of the Madison Capital Times and correspondent for The Nation magazine. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
And welcome to Wisconsin.
Well, it's great to be here.
It's good. So,
John, as we listen to these different voices, the summary of the commission's account of what happened on 9/11, your response?
Well, first off, I'm sure glad Henry Kissinger didn't write this. Initially, the Bush administration tried desperately to throw roadblocks in the way of this investigation in a number of steps. Cheney, for instance, wanted to block it altogether. When they couldn't block it, they tried to put Henry Kissinger in charge, knowing that they could always count on him to sweep anything important under the rug. That was beaten, and it's one of the biggest victories, I think, for really the forces of light in this country, because this report is imperfect. We'll find plenty of things in it that we disagree with and, you know, would like to see more exploration. But at the bottom line, it is certainly a good first draft of history. It provides us with a lot of information we didn't know. And it also does something in this period of really missing skepticism on most issues, some real challenges to this administration. It says that, A, they never followed any of the instructions or advice of former Senator Gary Hart and former Senator Warren Rudman, who put a report in at the start of 2001 saying many of these issues that we've just heard about should have been addressed. And it also tells us that, you know, in excruciating detail, how if this country had its act together as regards internal defense, rather than rushing abroad looking for countries to invade, we might well have been able to, if not avert this attack altogether, at least have lessened its significance.
John Nichols of the Madison Capital Times and the Nation magazine. When we come back, we're going to be joined by the authors of a new book called Banana Republicans. And then we'll be back with John Nichols and Ed Garvey, the nation's leading rebel lawyer, to talk about Wisconsin as a battleground state. This is Democracy Now! Broadcasting from Wisconsin. We'll be back in a minute.
Escalate.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, broadcasting today from Madison, Wisconsin. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our 70-city exception to the Ruler's Book and Media Tour. Today, here in Wisconsin, celebrating community radio station WORT and community TV WYOU. Tomorrow, we'll be at Madison's Barrymore Theater at 7:30. Tonight, we'll be at the 10th anniversary celebration for the Center for Media and Democracy, publishers of PR Watch, and we're joined by the founders today of the center, John Stauber and Sheldon Rampton. They've written a number of books, including Weapons of Mass Deception, which deals with the buildup to the invasion of Iraq. Their latest book is just out, and it documents the right wing's rise to dominance in American politics. It's called Banana Republicans: How the Right Wing is Turning America into a One-Party State. For the first time since 1932, the Republican Party dominates at every level of the federal government. The GOP now controls both houses of Congress, the White House. Conservatives dominate the Supreme Court. The party also holds an edge in state electoral politics. Republican governors preside over 28 states, and the GOP holds a slight majority of state legislatures. Conservative voices dominate the editorial pages of most U.S. papers, reverberate throughout the echo chamber of AM talk radio stations. Even among the high-powered lobbying firms of Washington, D.C.'s K Street, the Republican Party holds sway. But I want to start with the 9/11 Commission hearings with John Stauber and Sheldon Rampton. Welcome both to Democracy Now!, broadcasting here in Wisconsin. John Stauber, your response to the commission report.
Well, the commission is interesting for a number of reasons, Amy. To my knowledge, no one on that commission took a public stand against the war. And in fact, some of them, like Bob Kerry, were advocates for the war in Iraq. Despite that, the commission has now concluded very strongly there's no credible evidence linking Saddam to the 9/11 attacks. Yet we still see this big lie propaganda tactic being used by the administration, coming right out and saying basically, oh yeah, we have evidence, we have evidence, we know their links, and it's all a bunch of hooey. It's always been a bunch of hooey. In our new book, Banana Republicans, we pick up where we left off in Weapons of Mass Deception, because one of the indications that indeed our democracy is in great trouble and we're moving towards a one-party state is when you can make the big lie tactic work, repeating an outrageous falsehood over and over and over to confuse the public and make them believe the falsehood. And this administration is still employing that big lie tactic when it comes to linking Saddam to 9/11. There is no link.
You start in Banana Republicans talking about the war at home. Sheldon Rampton, can you talk about the approach that the Republican Party has most recently taken in these few years, and who are the intellectual—who are providing the intellectual underpinning for this?
Sure. We begin the book by quoting from a pamphlet that was circulated by the Republican leadership to every Republican member of the U.S. Congress during the 2000 elections. The title of the pamphlet was "The Art of Political War: How Republicans Can Fight to Win," authored by David Horowitz. And the thesis of that pamphlet is that politics is a continuation of war by other means, and that in war the way to win is to be an aggressor. That is, in a nutshell, the philosophy that has underpinned the Republican Party and the right wing's rise to power in the United States. And you see it constantly reflected in their rhetoric. Right now, to an increasing and really unprecedented degree, you see a large sectors of the American population being denounced as traitors and treasonous in books published by people like Ann Coulter. The response of the White House to the New York Times editorial yesterday about the 9/11 Commission was to say, was to denounce the New York Times for being outrageous and partisan, and that's simply how the Republican right wing movement has developed. It's become intensely ideological to the point that, again, that when we titled the book "Banana Republicans," we're not simply referring to the fact that the Republican Party has achieved political dominance. We're also talking about this intensely vitriolic rhetoric of that moves us in the direction of a banana republic, a nation dominated by rhetoric of treason and traitors and national security that uses that as a justification for violating the rights of citizens.
You also talk about Grover Norquist, another prominent leader in the conservative movement's political war, quoting Horace Cooper, a former aide to House Majority Leader Dick Armey, saying, "I would call him our field marshal." Take it from there, John Stauber.
Well, Grover Norquist, I would say, is probably the most important right-wing political organizer in the country. And I think one thing that people on the left, progressives, liberals, need to understand is that when Hillary Clinton termed the right a vast right-wing conspiracy, she really hit the nail on the head. And what we do in this book is detail how Grover Norquist, since 1992, for instance, the last 12 years, every single Wednesday, week in, week out, has convened the most powerful elements of the right wing, from the far-right Christian coalition to the big business lobbyists to the think tanks to the right-wing media. Every Wednesday, they close the doors, they strategize, they plan, they decide what they're doing that week, what they're doing the next week, the next month, and they're back every Wednesday. And that's why the whole right wing seems constantly on message. And basically, I think the most easy way to understand what's going on with our government right now is that it has been taken over by anti-government zealots, such as Grover Norquist, who's very plain-spoken and blunt, and says things like his goal for the federal government is to half it over the next 25 years so you can get it down to the size where you can drown it in a bathtub. And he views the possibility that someday the United States might actually have a guarantee of health care for all our citizens as an extreme threat, and in fact says that if that ever happens, all hope is lost, we're moved to a social democracy. So I think the important thing to understand about Grover Norquist and the rest of the strategists in charge of the right-wing Republican Party is that these are really heirs to the John Birch Society. These people are still fighting the Cold War. And when they say, as Ann Coulter does, that liberals are engaged in treason for simply thinking liberal thoughts or acting in liberal ways, that's not just some macho metaphor. They really believe that, and they really are, as David Horowitz would say, out to, quoting Lenin, destroy all political opposition.
You talk about Grover Norquist in the 1980s going to the developing world. Can you talk about who he supported, Sheldon Rampton?
Yeah. Norquist spent the 80s traveling from one third world hotspot to another, supporting the right-wing guerrilla movements in places like Mozambique and Angola. On his
Mozambique, Renamo, and Jonas Savimbi's UNITA in Angola.
Exactly. He also has a memento in his office, which is a photograph of him posing with an AK-47 in Afghanistan. And that's not a memento from the current war in Afghanistan. It's from the 1980s when, of course, the Reagan administration was back backing the Mujahideen against the Soviet occupation. If it troubles Norquist that the Mujahideen has gone on to become the organizing base for al-Qaeda, he's never said so publicly. But what all this tells you about the man is that his domestic political organizing in the United States is strongly colored by his background as someone engaged in basically military intrigues overseas. Again, this is someone who sees politics as a war, and he said very clearly and bluntly that they feel now that they've defeated the Soviet Union, now it's time to take on the liberals in the United States and destroy them as well.
Mm-hmm. The states, what about the shift of not only the federal government, but at the state level, the shift of the party?
Well,
control.
The shift is very disconcerting, and you know, a lot of what we write about in the book is how the right-wing media dominates media now. And one of the most interesting things, I think, to both Sheldon and me in researching and writing the book was looking at, in our chapter, Block the Vote, how gerrymandering is being used by the Republican Party. And we report on states like Pennsylvania, for instance, where once the Republicans gain control of the governorship and both houses of the legislature in 2002, they were able to force through a radical gerrymandering that literally stole congressional seats, apparently legally, away from people who don't vote Republican. And this is an aggressive strategy. Sure, gerrymandering has gone on by both parties for 200 years, but what the Republicans have figured out is that when you completely control a state's governorship and legislatures, there's nothing stopping you from forcing through a radical gerrymandering that literally steals seats. And this disenfranchises not only the people in Pennsylvania who don't vote for these far-right Republican policies, but it disenfranchises people across the nation, because now states like Pennsylvania, where this extreme gerrymandering has been rammed through, are sending to our national Congress a party that has more Republicans, and it disenfranchises everyone nationwide when that Congress votes on critical issues.
You have this chapter, a segment of a chapter, 50 Ways to Draw Your District.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, there's been a lot of media attention on Texas. You know, we've all seen everyone from Jon Stewart to the national media covering what's happened in Texas. But there hasn't been the media analysis in the mainstream media explaining the significance of Texas. This is part of the national strategy orchestrated by people like Tom DeLay and Grover Norquist to really create what we call in the book this one-party state. And I think one of our most important points is no one knows who's going to win the White House in November, but what almost all political analysts are agreed on is that this hegemony of extreme-right Republican power is going to be still in place after November, no matter who does win the White House.
We're talking to John Stauber and Sheldon Rampton. They are the authors of Banana Republicans, How the Right-Wing is Turning America into a One-Party State. What about the echo chamber?
The right-wing has managed to dominate the media in the United States through a three-part strategy. The first part is that they have very systematically and effectively built their own unabashedly ideological media, by which we mean, of course, talk radio and things like Fox News, that make no bones, really, although they, you know, Fox calls itself fair and balanced. It's clearly closely allied with the Republican Party and the right-wing. So on the one hand, they build their own ideological media. On the other hand, they've systematically advanced the careers of right-wing journalists within the mainstream, and there are organizations in place that do that, that train them, that nurture them from their days as college campus journalists, get them internships at leading media outlets ranging from the New York Times to USA Today. And then finally, the third element in the strategy is to constantly bash the mainstream media for its alleged liberal bias, which is basically a way of working the refs. So on the one hand, they're constantly complaining about bias, while at the same time, they are constantly building their own unabashedly ideological media. And it's a very effective strategy.
Can you talk about the foundations that subsidize the media?
Sure. You know, when we look at the rise of the right, it's happened over the last 30 to 40 years, and it's been very disciplined. And wealthy philanthropists on the right, identified with specific foundations like SCAIF, Mellon, Bradley, Coors, have been very dedicated funders. It's let's give these people a little bit of credit because they've gone about taking over the government, moving the country to the extreme right, and they've accomplished it. And one of their first steps decades ago was to create this network of propaganda mills that are commonly called the right-wing think tanks. And today we see Heritage, AEI, CEI, Cato, and these are really all due to the funding of these far-right foundations. Hmm.
In one of your final chapters, the final chapter, Traitor Baiters, you go through a list of the charges of treason against various people. But maybe you can give us some of the examples of what happened and who is being called a traitor.
Sure. Sheldon, I'll let you do that, but I just want to preface it by saying, Amy, your program and the community stations have been some of the few media in this country who've highlighted this sort of repression.
Yeah, well, I mean, all sorts of people. I mean, people are familiar, for example, with the fact that the Dixie Chicks got yanked off the air by the Clear Channel after they criticized President Bush publicly in the build-up to the war with Iraq. But for example, in Tennessee, a state senator actually called for the deportation of critics of the war.
This was Tennessee State Senator Tim Burchett.
Right. He said, to criticize the war is treason, not patriotism. They ought to be run out of the country and not allowed back. You see the theme of treason also constantly reflected in the books that the right produces, things like Mona Charon's book, Useful Idiots, How Liberals Got It Wrong in the Cold War and Still Blame America, or Sean Hannity's book, Deliver Us from Evil, subtitled Defeating Terrorism, Liberalism, and Despotism, or Daniel Flynn's How the Left Hates America. And in terms of who he regards as the traitors, here's the list. He says, many of these anti-Americans are at the same time teachers, professors, journalists, news reporters, and even judges and politicians. That's a fairly broad swath of the American population just right there.
Interesting comments about Noam Chomsky.
Chomsky also is a traitor, according again to David Horowitz. Horowitz published a column calling him the most treacherous intellect in America, saying disruption in this country is what the terrorists want and what the terrorists need, and that is what the followers of Noam Chomsky intend to give them.
It's interesting when we go back to the headlines of today, something that Donald Rumsfeld said right now about how the war is going. Donald Rumsfeld saying, if the U.S. fails in Iraq, it is not because of what took place on the battlefield, but how the media has portrayed it. He said, quote, this much is certain. Coalition forces cannot be defeated on the battlefield. The only way this effort could fail is if people were to be persuaded that the cause is lost or that it's not worth the pain, or if those who seem to measure progress in Iraq against a more perfect world convince others to throw in the towel. He's really laying down the gauntlet here. He is saying it will be the press's fault.
That's interesting because, for example, William Odom, who was the head of the National Security Agency under Reagan and is a conservative, has already declared that the war in Iraq has already been lost and it's just a matter of getting out as quickly as we can, because there's ultimately going to be no other alternative. Now, that's a very conservative voice saying that. It's not the media, and what Rumsfeld is really doing when he makes a declaration like that is he's demonstrating one of the premises that we make of our book, which is that this administration and the Republican Party has become so intensely ideological that it can brook no criticism, and everything that ought to be acknowledged and heeded as a warning sign that things are not going right simply becomes more grist for the mill of their conspiracy theory, which is to suggest that all of these forces in American society, the media, all of the critics of the direction we're headed in, are betraying the nation.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Sheldon Rampton, John Stauber, Banana Republicans is the name of their book, How the Right Wing is Turning America into a One-Party State. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute. John Coltrane here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, broadcasting from Madison, Wisconsin, a battleground state. I'm Amy Goodman. Next week, the Bush and Kerry campaigns will intensify their campaigning for the November presidential elections. Both men will travel extensively across the country. Television and radio will see an unprecedented number of advertisements. The amount of money spent in this election is expected to break all previous records, particularly the Bush administration, which has amassed the largest campaign war chest in the country's history. At least at this point, the polls put Kerry and Bush more or less in a dead heat. And some observers believe the race will come down to a few battleground states, among them Wisconsin, where we're broadcasting from today. And Monday, we'll be broadcasting from Milwaukee. We're going to take a close look at this state, how it could impact the November elections. We're joined by John Nichols, editorial editor at the Madison Capital Times and a correspondent for The Nation magazine. We're also joined by Ed Garvey. He's perhaps Wisconsin's most well-known rebel lawyer. Rose to prominence as head of the National Football League's Players Union. In 98, he was the Democratic Party's candidate for governor. He lost that race, in which he was outspent nearly 13-1 by his Republican opponent, Tommy Thompson, who's now President Bush's Health and Human Services Secretary. Garvey heads up a law firm that, for years, has gone up against large corporations and the state of Wisconsin. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
It's great to be here.
It's good to have you with us. Ed Garvey, you have been particularly taking on the state around the issue of prisons. Can you talk about this?
Federal Judge Barbara Crabb appointed me to represent all the inmates at the Supermax prison, which was built by Tommy Thompson, as he said, for the worst of the worst. And he had sent a delegation around the country to figure out how he could make, in essence, the worst prison available. And so when I went down there, I could not believe it. In essence, people are isolated.
Where is it?
In Boscobel, Wisconsin. And they never see the light of day. They never get outside. They're in total isolation. The food is, as you can imagine, not exactly good. And they had a number of seriously mentally ill inmates. So our first line of attack was to get an injunction to remove the seriously mentally ill from these conditions. And they now have been removed. But there's still other problems. For example, the temperature gets up to 100 degrees in the cells. And so the judge has ordered that they air condition to reduce the temperature to 84. But the state of Wisconsin has appealed that, saying that they can cool off by eating ice chips and wearing short pants, which is quite remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Who said that in the state of Wisconsin?
Well, that's the official position now of the governor, the Department of Corrections, that this is the way they're going to deal with it. And they're afraid that if there's air conditioning, that somehow other prisoners and other prisons would like to get into Supermax. But believe me, they've never been there if that's what they like. But this is, I think, part of the Thompson legacy. Wisconsin, believe it or not, is now spending more money on prisons than on the entire University of Wisconsin system. And that, I think, is such a tragedy because we've had great schools, a great university, and now our resources are being diverted simply for punishment.
You're taking on a number of corporations, from Walmart to Perrier. Explain.
Well, the Perrier fight was to come into Wisconsin and take millions of gallons of spring water. And a citizen group was organized, and we were able to stop them, and so they decided finally to leave the state. You would have enjoyed the first meeting. They had a public meeting, and about 200 people came, and they said, "We want to be good corporate citizens, so if you don't want us here, we'll leave." And 200 people said, "Leave." And they said, "Well, you can't be serious." Yes. Well, we kept up the battle, and they did have to leave. We've also been fighting Walmart, which is, in essence, trying to take over the state of Wisconsin's retail outlets. They're just building these super centers everywhere. And, of course, the impact on small merchants and small bookstores and so on is disastrous. And finally, I think one of the important battles is fighting against factory farms that they want to have in Wisconsin. We've been able to stop four or five of those, and hopefully we'll keep going.
What do you mean by factory farms?
These would be like 10,000 hogs in one location, 2,800 cattle, 2 million chickens, without regard for what it would do to the ground. Water, the air, the introduction of antibiotics into the system. So we've been saying, listen, these are not stewards of the land. These are just profit-oriented companies that could care less about the groundwater or the environment, the air, the smell, and so on and so forth. So we've been reasonably successful on getting citizen groups into the process. We can't do it at the state or national level, largely because of the amount of money that these big corporations put into the campaigns. So we've been doing it at the grassroots level and rather effectively.
John Nichols, what does it mean to say that Wisconsin is a battleground state?
Well, what it means is that the political powers that be in the country have decided that this is where they're going to have their fight. It's based on some reality. Wisconsin is a relatively closely divided state. We have two Democratic senators, one of whom is probably the most progressive guy in the Senate right now, Russ Feingold. He's up for re-election, and he'll get re-elected easily. But we also have Republican control.
The only one who voted against the USA Patriot Act.
Yeah, and the only person in a competitive race this year who is an outspoken foe of the war and continues to say it was a bad idea. I mean, but so we have that. But at the same time, we've had Tommy Thompson as governor for a long time. We now have a Democratic governor, titularly. And we have a Republican-controlled legislature. So it's a closely divided state. But to be a battleground state is something more than that. What it means is that the Republican and the Democratic power brokers in Washington have picked 17 or 18 states around the country that they say are, you know, the places where each of them have a chance of winning. So they're pouring all of the money in to these states. Your listeners in a lot of states in this country would be shocked to know that this presidential race is, you know, in full force. In fact, interestingly enough, in Wisconsin, both the Kerry and the Bush campaigns have already spent millions of dollars on TV. We see TV ads every day here, whereas people in states like Illinois, New York, California see no ads whatsoever. So choosing out the battleground states is, in my view, A, terribly undemocratic. It's a horrible, horrible thing to do because it cuts most of the country out of the debate. But B, it is a way to telescope the fight. And the fight has been telescoped here. If I can add one final thing that's important. Wisconsin wouldn't be a battleground state if the Democratic Party stood for anything. And this is a really big deal. In 1988, when Michael Dukakis was the Democratic nominee, he was hardly a great left-winger. But he had a good farm policy, pretty good industrial policy. He was pro-labor. He was against the death penalty. He was against U.S. policies in Central America. He won 55% of the vote in Wisconsin, pretty close to a landslide victory. This state would vote for a progressive Democrat. The problem is, when you give us a Bill Clinton or an Al Gore, they don't even get, they barely get to the 50% range. And this is John Kerry's challenge. If he were to run as a progressive Democrat, he'd win Wisconsin easy. If he runs as kind of a murky Republican light, he'll have a fight.
We were talking about the echo chamber earlier with John Stauber and Sheldon Rampton, the right-wing media in this country. Ed Garvey, you've written a very interesting piece in the Capital Times, John Nichols' paper, headlined, "Right Wing Now Hijacking PBS by Moving to Control Content." Can you talk about what's happening?
Well, last summer, or actually last fall, John and Bob McChesney held a conference here at Wisconsin on media reform. And at that conference, I spent some time with Chuck Lewis for the Center for Public Integrity. And we talked about how Dennis Hastert and other Republicans were pressuring the PBS to have a co-host with Bill Moyers on his wonderful program Now. And they wanted either Newt Gingrich or Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson is this fellow on CNN that I don't think anyone takes seriously. Predictably, Bill Moyers refused. But now what's happening with Moyers retiring in November, this summer they're going to have a magazine program hosted by Tucker Carlson. They're adding a program hosted by Paul Gigot, the editorial page editor of the Wall Street Journal, not exactly a liberal newspaper. And they're forcing some people onto the PBS board, one of whom was the former GOPAC director for Newt Gingrich's efforts to implement the contract on America, or for America. I never remember which one. So I'm worried about PBS because for years the Republicans claim it's left wing, but of course we know it's not. Most of the people they interview are very establishment and, if anything, lean toward the Republican side of things. But it is the, you know, in addition to what you're doing here, a source that at least we can hope we're not going to get the Fox News slant.
You call on Wisconsin Public Television to jump into the void by balancing this new programming of PBS.
I do, but I'm not very optimistic about it. Even Wisconsin Public Radio, which is quite good in Wisconsin, is nervous. And, for example, they think your program has a particular point of view, and that would not be permissible. They won't. Our public television here will not allow a union, for example, to sponsor a program because they think that unions have a point of view, whereas the corporations are only interested in profit. Well, that's going to be hot news to people listening here. So I do think, however, that it has awakened a number of people in Wisconsin, put some pressure on public radio and public television to take up the challenge. I don't want to see PBS becoming a mirror image of Fox News, and that's what I'm afraid the Republicans are pushing for.
John Nichols, last comment.
My last comment is that Wisconsin's a great state, and I'm sitting next to a guy who should be the governor of Wisconsin.
Sounds like he's running.
Did pretty
for
well. Now, the thing people should know that in Wisconsin there was a tremendous amount of anti-war sentiment. People here aren't that surprised by all the things that are coming out now, because I think this is still a very skeptical, very challenging state, and I'm glad that John Kerry and George Bush are going to be forced to have to come and talk to Wisconsinites, because they'll hear a lot more sensible ideas and comments than they would in Washington.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. John Nichols, the Capital Times, based here in Madison, and Ed Garvey, rebel attorney. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. We'll be in Madison, Wisconsin tonight. Tomorrow in Stevens Point at the Renewable Energy Fair at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And as we continue the Exception to the Rulers tour, tomorrow night back in Madison. On Sunday at 1 o'clock, we'll be at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where we will also be celebrating MATA, which is a public access television in Milwaukee that airs Democracy Now. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to find out all the details of the places we'll be here in Madison, as well as Milwaukee and Stevens Point. On Monday, we'll be broadcasting from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Democracy Now! Produced by Jeremy Scahill, Shrew Abdul Qudus, Mike Burkhan, and Nagara Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.